If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Pella Nuroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Nuroth-Taylor Show. On our second hour on this Tuesday afternoon, we've got two fantastic guests with us. We've got Erik Andersson, who's going to expose the secrets of Nord Stream, this explosion that deprived Europe of cheap gas. And we've got Danny Katz, who's an American, who's going to tell us about her courses and her books to teach young people to be resistant to propaganda, which I think is essential to democracy. So stick around that for the next hour. So I'm just going to talk about, draw your attention to the fact that it's 25 years ago, almost to the very day, when NATO carried out its first aggression on Serbia. Just the background, because it's very relevant to what's going on today. And I think that what happened there informs a whole generation of leaders in Russia and helps us explain why, to some extent, the Russians are acting as they are. And I think understanding is good for diplomacy and for peace. 25 years ago, there were Yugoslavia was consisted of Serbia and Kosovo and Montenegro. I think it had been sliced up in a civil war that had taken place a couple of years earlier. Bosnia broke out, and then Croatia and Slovenia, and they now had peace for a couple of years. Now, Kosovo wanted out. Now, Kosovo consisted mostly of Albanians, but it was a historic Serbian territory, and Serbs still comprised 20% of the population, and it was the cradle of Serb nationalism, if you like, and that Albania had a much, much higher birth rate. So it had gone from 50-50 Serbian, 50 Albanian to 80% Albanian, 20% Serbian by the 1990s. But there are many Orthodox churches there that Serb politicians wanted to protect, and which Serb nationalists, Serb school classes went to visit every year as being highly important to Serbian statehood and nationhood. Well, what happened was the West sponsored this movement called the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, that started out using small attacks on Serbian police, and then more and more aggressive from Serbian perspective, insurrection, if you like. And the it culminated called the Rashak Massacre. And the Rashak Massacre was apparently coordinated by some of the alternative media I read on the incident by a CIA official, been very active in South America. And he talked up what had been a regular assault by Serbian security forces against a rebel KLA stronghold. And they all died. I mean, it was a shootout. But the Rashak Massacre, as it was telephoned into the world's media from this diplomat stroke intelligence official from the United States who turned up there, was presented as a massacre of civilians only. And that was a very controversial thing. I mean, there were civilians, but there were activists whose guns had been taken away from them. So they seemed to be civilians. And that was a kind of a trigger for increasing pressure on Serbia to give up Kosovo. And when they didn't do that, NATO states avoiding a UN Security Council resolution went ahead and bombed this country, Serbia, and it's still a very big event in Serbian folk memory because they see themselves as part of Europe, and they were astonished that this happened. Thousands of civilians died, hundreds of soldiers, bridges were destroyed, a top hotel was cruise missiled. Famously, the Chinese embassy was destroyed, and the Chinese have never quite forgiven the West for doing that, because it was alleged that there was an intelligence center for giving the Serbs intelligence information from satellites. The Russians are traditionally allied with the Serbs, but they're very weak at this point. But what happened was the Western media, and anyone who's sort of 40 or above will probably remember on ITV and the BBC, these endless rows of Serb Albanians sitting in their horse carts going to Albania itself for Greece. And an emotional Bill Neely, I think he is, Britain's top tearjerker correspondent, saying these people are fleeing genocide. Well, actually, it's turned out that the death toll was quite low. And this kicking out process by the Serb security forces was started after the NATO bombing. So the NATO bombing of Serbia started, and then the Albanians were pushed out of the country. Now, what's interesting is there's a guy called Kit Klaringberg, who's a British journalist living in Serbia. He's a very sort of a dedicated investigative journalist. He's gone to the British archives, and he finds that the British were the ones pushing for ground troops in Serbia. The Americans were holding back. Blair was pushing Clinton, and Clinton told his officials, there's too much, he's put something in his cornflakes, Blair has, we don't know why he wants to do this. The British wanted to accelerate the bombing. Of course, all this was using American hardware, not British hardware. And then Blair was making his famous speech in Chicago on the back of this bombing of Serbia about spreading democracy through the sword. You know, dictatorships have to be bombed, like Serbia, which nominated a dictatorship, so they could become democratic and lose people who were tyrannized by them. And of course, that led directly to the Iraq War. And the Iraq War has led directly to the Ukraine War, because the Russians are saying, you attacked Iraq, why can't we attack Ukraine? The point is, Serbia actually folded from this bombing when the Russians intervened and said, we're not going to support you anymore, give in to NATO. NATO never acknowledged this, and Blair saw it as a vindication of his aggressive approach. And he's never really realized or understood that you can't bomb countries to democracy, and diplomacy and all this special forces and all this British hawkishness, it's all got its legacy today, and you see it today. So I advise you to look up Kit Clarenberg. I think he's got a Substack, and he gives a very good account of this story. History affects and informs and reflects the present. Talking about the present, we've got our political editor with us today for a second time, Basil Valentine. We'll be back after a very quick break. This is TNT News Talk.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. And we've got Basil Valentine with us, our political editor. How are you doing, Basil?
Very well, thank you, Pelle, and good to be with you again this cold March afternoon here in Britain. Very quickly first, I'm delighted to say that Kit Clarenberg, who you mentioned earlier, one of Britain's foremost investigative journalists, certainly when it comes to the machinations of the British state, he will be on Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn tomorrow morning at 10:20 UK time, 11:20 Central European time. And he's promised to drop some truth bombs. So make sure you tune in for that soon after 10:15 tomorrow morning, UK time, on Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn. Meanwhile, today, I want to highlight a story that we need to ascertain. Is this smoke without fire? Is this a storm in a teacup? Is this another attempt at ramping up tensions between the West and a country to the East? In this case, China. The United States and UK claims to have exposed a global Chinese hacking plot that targeted White House staff and the State Department, as well as British MPs and the Electoral Commission. Washington and London have announced sanctions on two individuals and one company linked to APT31, a China state-affiliated group, in response to cyber attacks that apparently endangered national security. First of all, the attack on the Electoral Commission, the UK electoral watchdog, this was first identified in October 2022, but the hackers apparently had first been able to access the Commission's systems for more than a year previously, since October 2021. It exposed the personal data of 40 million voters, as the Commission holds the name and address of everyone in the UK registered to vote between 2014 and 2022, as well as the names of those registered overseas. It also emerged that a group of MPs and peers with hawkish views on China had been spied on by Beijing. They were among 43 parliamentary email accounts targeted with malicious tracking links. Oliver Dowden, the Deputy Prime Minister, told the House of Commons that any hostile cyber activity directed towards UK parliamentarians is completely unacceptable, and said that the two attacks demonstrated a clear and persistent pattern of behaviour that signals hostile intent from China. What do you think they could expect to gain from accessing the names and addresses of 50 million voters in the UK, Pelle?
Yeah, I mean, that's I believe it. I think my view, I don't know, you pick up information from so many sources and you kind of build it into your own worldview. Everyone hacks each other for a start, and everyone hack. So, I mean, I think the British and CIA all hack. When Clinton opened up her archives or whatever, she wasn't very good about computer security. Everyone was there within 5 minutes rooting around and getting her stuff out. So I think everyone's doing it. And the first question is why they're revealing this now, because it's probably been going on for decades, everyone hacking each other. I mean, they're trying to fill, is there a news angle to this that they're trying to create a momentum for something, the British and Americans? So they're trying to cover, look here, don't look there kind of thing, you know? We all have to focus on China. Are they doing the Americans a favor by pointing this out? And then the question, as you said, you know, why? What could the Chinese possibly benefit from this? You know, I mean, do they have enough experts who can pass British politics and make a difference? I mean, my big worry. I mean, I think that you know, we talk about Epstein and Mossad or whatever, and photographing young women in the company of politicians and then threatening to expose that. What worries me, I mean, I haven't seen the proof of it, but maybe no one is afraid of talking. Everyone's afraid of talking about it because they know they'll be next if they talk about it in the mainstream media. That is that we've got CCTV cameras, we've got all got mobile phones that are like spy machines. How much do our intelligence agencies know about us, including our politicians? And could that account for the extreme lack of, I don't know, creative thinking or lack of spine in our politicians? I mean, why are we heading towards World War III? Because if you do something, you'll get, what's that health secretary, Matt Hancock, you know, he was snogging his girlfriend outside his offices, was captured by a CCTV camera. And obviously, they probably had that in store. They probably have a file, video files on every single politician. And if they step out of line or if they're out of favor or something, or maybe it was just used as a warning. All you guys, Matt Hancock, he was a promising young politician, and now he's doing celebrity TV because his promising young career was torched by his snogging of a woman who was not his wife. So, you know, pour encourager les autres, as they say. So that's what I worry. And we should have discussion about this. And of course, this guest I had on yesterday, Christine Hart, very interesting, smart woman, very sort of connected and kind of, you know, willing to spill the beans. This nexus between intelligence agencies and the tabloid newspapers, I mean, they're sometimes the same people, you know, and sometimes they employ the same private detectives, come investigative journalists. And so, and I guess, I don't know, maybe this is just kind of laddish culture, which doesn't think as much as we think they think, not so much planning, but they have. So what I'm saying is, the intelligence agencies in the UK know that they've got go-to people in the media, especially the tabloids. They can drop a bombshell if someone displeases them, you know, and that really worries me much more than the Chinese. Because I think the Russians are quite skilled in political warfare because they know the European scene quite well and they do political warfare all the time. But I don't think the Chinese, I don't know. I mean, their culture seems so removed from ours and they don't seem to be doing that sort of thing. I could be wrong. I mean, I know a lot of Americans I talk to are convinced the Chinese are Psy warriors of the highest skill, you know. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's the language that we get from politicians in response to this that concerns me. The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, one of the names being touted as a possible replacement for Rishi Sunak, has said that it is, and I quote, abundantly clear that China is a hostile state posing, and this is the ridiculous language, an unprecedented threat to national security. She says there's a compelling case for adding China to the foreign influence registration scheme. I mean, unprecedented threat is way over the top as language. The tracking bug, if you like, that 43 parliamentarians were sent by this shadowy, admittedly shadowy sounding group affiliated to the Chinese state. Well, what that does is track you around the internet so they can find out which websites you've been to. You know, you do that. That happens every time you accept cookies, doesn't it? With endless pop-up accept cookies. We all get that all the time every time we go to a new website.
Yeah.
That tracks us on the internet. So, you know, to go from that to describing it as an unprecedented threat is simply ludicrous. We cannot afford to have bad relations with China. And, you know, where this sort of thing is uncovered, surely it's a question for you know, ambassadors to be summoned, all the cards on the table, what's going on, resolve the issues, rather than use language that just sort of escalates the whole thing to a place.
Do you think it's part of a leadership campaign against Sunak? I mean, there's a lot of displeasure about him. He hasn't provided the bump upwards in the polls that the Tories were hoping for. And maybe they're going to go for yet another Tory prime minister unelected before the election. And Suella Braverman is going to use the Chinese card. Do you think there's any thoughts about that?
Possibly. There's going to be another by-election, this time in the Blackpool South constituency. It's a Conservative MP who is resigning, having been involved in a lobbying scandal. For the 20 years prior to that, it was a Labour-held seat, having been won by the Labour candidate when Tony Blair swept the power in his 1997 landslide. So a real marginal seat currently held by the Tories. If the Conservative vote disintegrates in Blackpool South, then the possibility of a leadership challenge is raised. Finally, one other quick point. House Republicans appear to be on the brink of waving the white flag as their efforts to impeach President Joe Biden look stone dead.
Okay, Basil, we've got to end with today's news analysis today, but just to show you that we do our best to bring you the story behind the scenes and that are not immediately apparent when you just look at the BBC. Exactly. Isn't that what we do, Basil? Try and tell you the whole truth. So this is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We're going into our third guest of the second hour, and this is after a quick break. This is today's news talk on TNT.
TNT's Mark Morano.
And there's a whole history of this idea that the establishment, the powers that be, the regime in power, likes the idea of a little eco-terrorism to keep the population hungry. I mean, if you think about it, their policies, government policies of the Great Reset, Net Zero, Climate Agenda, are quite literally eco-terrorism or a form of terrorism. It's, as Jesse Jackson used to say, it's economic violence, it's economic terrorism. Jesse Jackson used to say that about the Reagan administration. But in this case, it's the intentional collapse of energy, food, transportation, free speech, all to achieve and make us safer and give them more power under the auspices, if you will, of a crisis.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
I said, could she die? And the doctor said she could. It was so scary.
When I started clawing at my neck and trying to breathe, and I thought, you know, what are we going to do if I die here? How's everyone going to go on?
When someone's gravely sick or injured in the bush, they rely on the Royal Flying Doctor Service. But now the Flying Doctor needs your help to fund vital medical equipment and supplies. Please search Flying Doctor online to give a regular gift of just $10. You can help equip the Flying Doctor's teams to respond to any emergency anywhere. Search Flying Doctor online. Become a part of the Royal Flying Doctor Service and help save lives in the bush.
You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk on this Tuesday afternoon. Our next guest is a Swede, Erik Andersson, who lives near Gothenburg and who's worked as an engineer all his life for Boeing, for Volvo, for various flight technology components companies. He's worked on trajectory optimization and aircraft performance modeling. And he is using those skills, or has used those analytical skills, to try and get to the bottom of Europe's biggest industrial sabotage ever, the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline that piped cheap gas from Russia to Germany and Europe in 2022. Now, no Swedish journalists have really come to a conclusion about who did this. And the Swedish official report didn't really give us much enlightenment either, or rather it was, I think it was not publicized, and the Swedes handed over their information to the Germans. But Erik Andersson has been doing the rounds and been telling us what his take on the story is. Welcome to the show, Erik.
Thank you.
So what's your take on this Nord Stream thing? You built up a lot of contacts when you started to investigate it.
Well, that's a pretty broad question. What's my take? I mean, for starters, it's been very secretive. And the Swedish investigation, of course, feels very, very disappointing since they somehow created an expectation that they were doing it very seriously. They picked up a lot of evidence from the crime scene, two containers of artifacts that they collected with divers. And they also took 50 meters of the pipe and stored it, and they analyzed it. They told us what explosive it was and blah, blah, blah. And the funny thing is that when they started this, they claimed falsely, you know, that they had jurisdiction to do so, that they could actually prosecute someone in Sweden, or at least they could take charge of the investigation. They could close off the area so no one else could get there. And then, you know, now recently they just took that back and said, no, we're closing it because we have no jurisdiction. So that's really an after construction and very, you know, strange.
And so who has jurisdiction? Because it was near the Danish island of Bornholm. So is it the Danes who have jurisdiction?
Well, this is international waters, and it's situated in something that's called the economic zone. So two of the explosions were in the Danish economic zone, and two of them were in the Swedish economic zone. But this economic zone really doesn't matter. I talked to some, you know, very renowned legal scholars on this, really the leading authorities on it, and they say, you know, you have economic zones to regulate fishing and to regulate who has access to natural resources like oil and gas below the surface. But it's not applicable. It's very specific to those businesses. It's not applicable in this case. So this take that you'd exclude other nations or stop a United Nations investigation, I mean, that's totally bogus. That's not what happened. What happened was that there were military ships there and even American military ships on the crime scene, and they took it over, and they moved it to a completely different domain than this legal domain. They just it was a military takeover. I mean, that's the best way of describing it, I think.
So you think that the Swedes were acting as cover for an American stroke Swedish investigation, which they took control over very early to stop maybe a Russians from doing something or the United Nations from doing something. And when things had calmed down a bit, they said, oh, well, actually, we didn't have jurisdiction to do this after all. And we're not we're going to quieten it down, and we're going to send it to Germany. And Germany's probably going to do nothing about it as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you just look at the way they behaved, I mean, there is no other explanation that's holding up, I think.
Do you think the Swedish military, which we know are very anti-Russian, do you think they knew beforehand, or were they genuinely didn't know and they were, could have opened to all possibilities and then discovered that it probably was the West or the Ukrainians that had done it, and then they then lost interest in following it?
Well, I guess we're all speculating when it comes to who knew. If you force me to guess, I would say some of the high level people actually knew, but maybe the civilian leadership in Sweden did not know, and most of the people who went out there, I mean, they maybe went out there in good faith, and maybe they did not know.
These two containers, do we know anything about their contents? Have they found any incriminating evidence that could point one nation or another?
They didn't. The only thing they told us is that they found the explosive, and it was the same explosive that they also claimed that they found on this sailboat Andromeda. They said they collected other artifacts, but what those are, we don't know. I know one journalist who has contact with the German investigation. He was asking if, you know, after there was contact between the Germans and the Swedes, he was asking if for instance, if there were these any traces of these sonar receivers that are present in Seymour Hirsch record of it, because he said that this was all triggered by some sonar device that listened to a sonar buoy that was dropped from an aircraft. Then the answer was that they did not find anything of that. But who knows? I mean, that's not just somebody denying something. We don't know if they're speaking the truth or what's going on here.
Well, after a quick news break in this 30 seconds or so, we're going to talk for 10 more minutes about, we're going to compare the two high theories that are out there. There's Seymour Hirsch, a very famous American journalist, who says it was a CIA operation, a very well-planned operation, using the Norwegians, I think, to drop a sonar buoy that actually triggered these explosions. And then there's the Washington Post version, which is kind of, and German version, which has been circulating much more widely than sonar, which is it was a Ukrainian sailboat, a kind of much smaller operation, but blames the Ukrainians in some vague way. We'll talk about what you think of those two theories and if there's a third theory after a quick news break. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Pelle Neroff-Taylor on TNT News Talk.
TNT Radio News.
Are you ready for some awesome news?
Yes. 1, 2, 3, 4!
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsed early on March 26 after being struck by the Singaporean flagged cargo ship, the Dolly, prompting emergency responses and a search for 7 people reported to be in the river. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, has received a conditional opportunity to appeal his extradition to the United States from the High Court in London. New Zealand is dispatching HMNZS Canterbury, equipped with 2 helicopters and crew, to the Solomon Islands to support the upcoming national elections.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroff-Taylor Show. We've got Erik Andersson with us, a Swedish engineer who's been researching Nord Stream pipeline explosion in September 2022 and has some interesting ideas. So, Erik, of the various hypotheses that have been mooted, do you go with any of them or do you think it's all disinformation?
Well, I think there are some striking similarities between these two stories that you're mentioning. You know, the Seymour Hirsch story and the Andromeda story, and so you know they're all involving divers. It's a pretty small operation. Seymour Hirsch was saying they were just digging a little bit into the mud, the bombs, and that's exactly what we found. That's what I found when I was out there with the drone. I think, I mean, the difference is, of course, that Seymour Hirsch said that Norwegians were involved. What I think is interesting is that there is a sequence of 3 stories, because there was some intelligence leak about a plan that was cabled out in the Teixeira leaks. So people with a security clearance in the U.S. were told this pretty early on. That in June, I mean, the summer before the actual blast, there was an attempt to rent a boat in Stockholm, and that would have 6 Ukrainian commandos. And this same thing with 6 Ukrainian commandos that reappeared in the story of that we're now supposed to believe was the actual thing. So my guess that I've said a couple of times is that that CIA or America was trying some different plans, and then when they turned out that they had some flaws, they ditched the plan and made a new plan. And the final plan that was finally executed was perhaps the sailboat plan, or at least the sailboat, I think, participated in the plan, because we know that for sure that the sailboat trip definitely happened. I mean, they were making 5 different port calls, and there are witnesses in these ports. So I've seen the guys, they were buying fuel with cash, and they had full spare parts and all these things. So I think it happened, but it really doesn't matter that much whether they were the final guys who put the bombs there or not, because this trip was, if it if it wasn't them, you know, it was still organized by the same team that actually blew up Nord Stream. I think that's pretty established. Yeah.
Couldn't these be just cover guys? And then they make a lot of noise and draw a lot of attention to themselves. And then the real team does it. And then we don't identify those. And then someone is, when this false team does it, the Ukrainians, everybody, you get the opposition journalists or investigative journalists say, well, it's obviously the Ukrainians because they were seen around this port, these ports. And then someone's going to say, well, it can't have been the Ukrainians because they don't have the capacity or the diving equipment to go down to these depths. And you can't fit in a diving chamber on a small sailing boat. So you, in a way, you kill that trail, and then you're kind of left in a limbo, in a mystery. So they were just cover, basically, and the real team was doing something else, somewhere.
That's a possibility, of course, but it's a very very elaborate cover,
right?
And it seems like they have been able to fool the German investigation, I get this secondhand, but I mean the Germans I'm talking to who are in contact with the investigation, they have a lot of respect for this team in Germany that does this. I mean, it's like they were breaking the Bader-Meinhof leak and other botched other terrorist attacks, and they think that these are really Sherlock Holmes. I mean, these are smart people with integrity, and they thought that this was controversial to point out the Ukrainian, because they were afraid that if it was Ukraine, Ukraine wouldn't get any more tanks or military support from Germany. So it was like, when it was broken, it was considered something very controversial in Germany. So I mean, it's a very, if it's a cover, it's a very cunning, you know, a very very smart and elaborate thing.
Yeah, I mean, you could be right. Of course, your German contacts could be right. I have no idea, but I was just thinking that if it was the British or the Americans, to do that against an ally, Germany, you know, is even worse, I think. And I'm also thinking that maybe the Ukrainians and the British Special Boat Service, they love to do these things. I mean, they're everywhere. They're very active in the Black Sea and Crimea and so on.
Yeah.
And the British command, and of course, the British submarines, which you alluded to in one of your other interviews, you know, they were very active in the Swedish submarine scandals of the 1980s. That was British submarines and American submarines. And they, I think they even carried out their annual, final submarine captain exercises at the same time as they were harassing Olof Palme and his Social Democrat government. They were sending big British submarines into Swedish waters.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, we don't know anything. There's no evidence that speaks, that debunks this. It says that it definitely was not a submarine. I think, you know, one of the things that is pointing to that it could have been a very low scale, a low profile thing with amateurs is that they seem to have placed two bombs on the same pipeline, and that was a mistake. The plan was to blow up all four pipelines. But two of the bombs ended up on the same one. And my theory is that is because there's a disturbance in the magnetic field in one of the areas, so that the divers were they were disoriented by their magnetic compasses, and they put the bomb on the wrong pipeline. And that's something that you wouldn't do if you had like big scale military equipment, and you would have other means of navigating, and you wouldn't do such a basic mistake. And many people are. Maybe that's why I'm being interviewed by mainstream newspapers, because I'm supporting this theory of a possibility of a sailboat because of this blunder.
Well, in a way, your theory, I mean, I absolutely have respect for your contacts and your analysis, is in a way that the more palatable alternative. And I'm sort of thinking that if the Germans are going to throw the Ukrainians in front of the bus, you know, I mean, there's talk about what we're going to do about the Ukrainians. That's sort of an excuse a little bit, I think. But is there talk of a deadline for what do you think the Germans are going to do? Any idea about that? And are they going to name names? I mean, these commanders are probably still alive somewhere.
The expectation is that they will name names, and they will bring, prosecutions. They will bring charges towards some people. That's the expectations. That's what people are telling me is going to happen. But I don't know, you know, how important it is who actually did it. I hope the charges are against the people who organized it in the end, and not someone who was, you know, paid or ordered to do it.
Sure. Yeah. But that's going to be, might be difficult, that because the big countries, they have two or three lines of covering. I think, you know, they'll, it's plausible deniability. That's how the intelligence agencies have worked since the beginning. They hire someone who hires someone.
Yes.
And I think it's probably the same. That's why we're trying to, everyone is messing around with these names in the Crocus attack in Moscow. And even like the Palmer assassination, I was down in South Africa and I talked to the South Africans and they blamed the British. But it could, they said that we were given orders by Margaret Thatcher to kill Olof Palme. And the, but, but the South Africans could have been the ones doing it, and they blame Nsepo. It's all confusing. I've been researching these things for so many years, and it's always frustrating because the trails always go in different directions. You know, anyway. So how's the Swedish media been treating this latest trail? Have you been, because they haven't been very active on this topic, have they?
Well, there was a very concerted effort to talk about the Andromeda scandal, the Andromeda, the sailboat trip. I mean, the German Der Spiegel and the television channel there, they even tried to, they rented the yacht again and did and did the like a trip on it. So there was, it's been a lot of focus on it, but not really digging up any new information. It's more like communicating this story. So I think the media is totally uninteresting. I mean, there was a new an insurance thing coming up now because Nord Stream has sued its insurance companies, which is quite interesting. They had an insurance against war and terrorism, a special section in the insurance. So I think the outcome of that lawsuit is very interesting, but I see extremely little coverage. It was a small note in Financial Times, and that's it.
Okay, and where, what are you doing next? Are you still pursuing this story, or are you engaged in other projects?
Well, I mean, whenever something new comes up, I'm trying to pursue this. I mean, maybe we'll do another expedition to the crime scene. I mean, we found a boot, for instance. It's quite interesting. Nobody seems to be interesting. I think the boot is still there. I mean, we should pick up the boot and see what.
Okay, we'll have to interview you again when you show the boot in front of the television, the camera next time. Okay, Erik Andersson, an engineer and who's researched the Nord Stream pipeline explosion and has a very interesting theory about it really being the Ukrainian commandos using a small sailboat. And it could be, because he's got very good sources. Thank you, Erik Andersson. This is Pelle Nerov Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We've got our fourth guest in just a moment.
I'm CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Isaac Sanchez. And normally we like to provide you with tips on how to keep yourselves and your family safe during wildfires. But given the historic impacts that the weather has had on our state this year, we would like to provide you with tips on how to keep yourself safe during extreme weather. If you reside in an area susceptible to flooding, please take the necessary steps to prepare to evacuate if advised. Make sure you've identified at least two exit routes out of your neighborhood, as one of them may be blocked or flooded. As the weather develops, remember to check in on vulnerable neighbors and family members. They may need additional time to prepare for evacuation. And just like during a wildfire, if you feel unsafe, please evacuate. You don't have to wait for the order to come. Keep an emergency go bag ready in case you need to evacuate. And always remember to plan for the safety of your pets as well. If you must leave, never drive around roadblocks. It can take as little as 12 inches of water to sweep your vehicle away. And always remember the mantra, turn around, don't drown. Be aware of first responders working in highly impacted areas, especially on the roads. For additional safety tips and updates on CAL FIRE activities, follow us on social media or visit fire.ca.gov.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go, but I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there, providing hot meals, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding.
To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Deconstructing PSYOPs, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Our final guest today on today's afternoon show is Danny Katz, who's with us from California and who's established a reputation as one of LA's edgiest literary talents by way of her bold voice, her expanded perspective, and her mastery of language. She's written hundreds of articles for LA Weekly, Los Angeles Times, New Teen Vogue, and other magazines. And she's going to talk to us about her latest project, which is to teach young people to learn about and combat propaganda in the mainstream news and elsewhere. This is a project that's very close to my heart. So welcome to the show, Danny.
Hi, Pele. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about this project, because I think propaganda is so pervasive and combating it is so important I'm open to any solutions.
Good. I'm so happy to hear it. So I had spent the bulk of my adult career trying to stave off everything that we've been going through for the past 4 years. And it was shortly after I wrote Plandemic 2 Indoctrination with Mickey Willis and they installed Biden into the White House that I realized, oh, okay, my efforts have failed. The adults have chosen their enslavement timeline. Why don't I focus my efforts on the youth to make sure that this doesn't ever happen again? So I created this course called Pop Propaganda, which teaches teens media literacy, media manipulation, how to safeguard their critical thinking while at the same time building their critical thinking, building their self-esteem, and learning all the tricks, techniques, and tools that the social engineers are using to attempt to manipulate us. Because once we know how those tricks work, they no longer work on us. And we can start to see all the smoke and mirrors coming at us through the screens.
What a fantastic project. It's like, you know, we have all these magicians doing these magicians' tricks on us, and you're like showing us how the tricks are done. And I mean, you know, magicians are harmless, I guess, but this is for our democracy and for our freedom. So it's absolutely essential. Can you give us some concrete examples of how the techniques work and what specific aspects of the technique, the propaganda you're counteracting?
Sure. Well, there's the most recent incident when Trump was talking about the automobile manufacturing happening in Mexico and that it would be a bloodbath if he didn't put a stop to it, and how the media cherry picked that. So this is a perfect example of cherry picking, taking a tiny bit of truth completely out of context to prop up an agenda. You know, the entire journalism space is rife with editorialization. They're not showing us two sides of every story. They're doubling down on one side. The ad hominems, the name calling, you know, take your pick.
Well, okay. But I mean, you're in California, which is quite a democratic state, isn't it? And by conservatives, it's held up as an example of how this beautiful, very successful state is doing everything wrong, you know, and you've written for LA Times and LA Weekly, Teen Vogue and Vice. All those are kind of quite progressive outlets. Did you see this at the outlets you were working for? Or maybe we shouldn't talk about that. I don't want to deprive you from a livelihood and writing for these magazines. But those names are particularly in my space, in my knowledge, like Vice and so on. They would take a particular stance on topics like Trump and so on. So did you see propaganda in some of these outlets and in Californian outlets generally?
100%. I'm actually not in California anymore. I left California in 2019. I think you were sent a bit of an out-of-date bio on me. Oh, and yes, okay. I was ejected from all of those publications a while back. So I saw it, you know, the LA Weekly I was writing for about 10 years. And as soon as they were purchased by the Village Voice, then everything had to have a slant. So that happened around 2009, 2008, when that really went sideways. I was booted from Reality Sandwich, where I used to write, back in 2012, when I wrote about gender reassignment surgery as seen through the lens of the 53rd gene key. So that got me kicked out of Reality Sandwich. After I wrote Plandemic 2 Indoctrination with Mickey Willis, then I was kicked out of the Santa Fe Reporter. I had moved to New Mexico at that point. So I have been rejected from all mainstream journalism, most alt journalism. They've all been completely co-opted. I was in the newsroom during 9/11. Back then, I was reporting and producing the news for Pacifica, and they brought in a very obvious CIA agent to take over the newsroom and start slanting the news in a certain way back in 2001. So yes, I'm seeing everything that you're seeing, and anyone who's not following the party line is no longer allowed to participate in the journalism game, which is really now just a euphemism for state-controlled propaganda.
Well, it's interesting you're saying Radio Pacific. I mean, even sitting here in Europe, I'd heard of them, and I thought they had quite a good reputation for actually being more open than the rest of the Californian and the US media. But you're saying that they were co-opted by the CIA.
Correct. At the time, I had been in the newsroom for quite a while, and we had the new news director come in, and I pitched a 60-second good news segment once a week, and he said, "You're fired. You clearly have no idea what we're trying to do here." And we can see what's happened with Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman, and they've all just like fallen in line with this like deeply editorialized form of non-journalism where everything is completely slanted. And it's really over the top. So a big part of this course that I created is teaching the students, and to be clear, that I created this course for teens and grown-ups alike, but it teaches us how the media has been co-opted, kind of a lay of the land, and also how to do our own due diligencing, how to do our own fact-checking, how to follow the money so that we can start to vet the information coming through the screens and decipher for ourselves what's true, what's fake, what's propaganda, what's real.
How would you fact check, let's say, the bloodbath story?
So primary precept for that is look when a when someone is propping up a quote, and especially at that volume, look up the original speech in its entirety. Always. Same thing when someone takes a segment out of a bill or a piece of legislation, go to the government website, look up that legislation yourself so that you can start to understand how things are taken out of context.
When Vladimir Putin made his speech about to peace the other day, the Wall Street Journal quoted it entirely out of context and only said, we can't have peace with these people in Kiev at the moment, but we're very, very ready to talk about it, provided they don't have fantasies about what they can achieve when they're under the influence of psychotropic drugs. Zelensky, of course, being a cocaine addict or whatever. So there's just an example, and that went viral. And Reuters and AP, which is kind of the gold standard of journalism, millions of people read it and quote from it and cite it. And many quite mature journalists believe what they read on Reuters, but they're just as bad as the rest of them. I mean, unfortunately. That's very interesting. And do you think that are you achieving success? Because young people don't have a lot of life experience, you know, and it's all about status and trendiness. And I guess these magazines like Vice, they go for lifestyle, coolness, I guess, and BuzzFeed and so on. So what are the challenges, I should say, to reaching out to young people?
I think right now the challenges are simply getting them to know that I'm teaching this course. I'm heavily, heavily suppressed and censored. But what I've noticed, and to answer your question, yes, it's extremely successful. I've taught this course live multiple times. So the parents who are signing up the teens are very often more patriots, more people who aren't buying the party line. So oftentimes the teens will rebel and then double down on Black Lives Matter, trans rights, Ukraine, like whatever it is. And when I explain to them, and I always say, you know, throughout the course, I'm not here to teach you what to think. I'm here to teach you how to think. Whatever you come to of your own accord, I respect, as long as you are actually thinking. So when I explain to the students, look, the system is set up to capitalize on you having no self-esteem. So they will go out of their way to let you know you're not enough, you're too much, you're too stupid to make up your mind yourself, right? So we have that kind of basis. Then when I teach them the tricks being utilized to manipulate the youth, especially, be it repetition, be it, you know, drumming up emotions, right? Having a big emotional reaction. Once they start to see the tricks, the teens so easily and naturally just let go of their ideological allegiances. I don't have to push at all. Once they see how it works, they're like, oh, okay, I don't want to play this game. So it's very, very successful in that way, because there's no pushing, or I'm not trying to force any of my students into agenda. I'm just showing them, here's how it works and here's how we're all being played. And I think that's a big piece of it, is including myself in that. I think a lot of us who understand what's going on, it does us a disservice when we're saying, well, you're being played and you don't understand. But when I include myself in it, it's easier for everyone to soften into the horrors of the propaganda situation we're currently being invited to flip.
Well, I'll tell you a little personal story, and that is that, you know, there's a saying which I sometimes quote in my unorganized way of trying to spread the truth. I mean, you're doing courses and things, but I say to people, you know, it's funny, isn't it? When we have personal knowledge of a story or a topic, we all say these journalists are idiots. I mean, and this is not just politicized issues, but let's say technical stuff. But that suddenly we believe them when we're reading. We forget how much we despise these journalists. And then the next day, oh gosh, is that true? You know, because they're writing about a topic we don't have personal experience of. So we assume it's true, and it's difficult to get out of that habit, you know? So I'm sure I'm being constantly propagandized, and I'm just, the best thing is just accept it and be modest or not arrogant about it. And I'm probably subjected to Russian or Chinese propaganda. I mean, I know slouches and that, except you want to sort of believe it's something, the truth is somewhere in the middle. So it's good to get the other. I think it's a brilliant idea to enfranchise the youth, young people, to feel they're in command and can fight back rather than just tell them, because of course they're going to kick back against that as well, aren't they? And you're sort of teaching them how to fish rather than giving them fish. And you're giving them the toolbox. I mean, I'm amazed we don't have those lessons in civics class, you know. Instead of, we should learn about chemistry and physics and so on, absolutely, and higher maths, algebra. But we should also learn how to fill out a tax form or how to vote or I don't know, practical things that'll actually stand us in good stead. And one of those major things, I think, is learning propaganda. I really think so, you know. So I think you're doing a fantastic project. Are you able to scale it up, or are you sort of doing the courses in face-to-face or online or what?
Thank you for asking, and I agree with everything you're saying. It's really incumbent upon us to be humble and to realize that we are all susceptible to propaganda, including me, right? And to just keep that in mind. So yes, I've recently turned the course into a digital course so that everyone across the world can purchase it, get instant access, not be reliant upon me teaching it. My next phase is to get it into some of the universities who aren't taking this stance, the Christian universities, perhaps, into some of the red state school system. Like, that is my aim, is to scale this up. But as of now, anyone in the world can buy this course, get instant access at www.poppropaganda.com.
Poppropaganda, okay, with two P's.com. And they can type in your name. We've got two more minutes. So do you think the intelligence agencies could actually, their presence in the left, on the so-called progressive media, I mean, they're pro-war, but pro-transgender. And under the transgender label, they actually hide that they're doing the work of the American empire, the deep states. And that I meet a lot of young leftists who just don't see this. And I'm so glad I'll put them straight to your course. But are these people just working with intelligence agencies for the fun of it? I mean, because they get leads from them, or do they actually get paid? Are they on the payroll of the intelligence agencies?
And who are the people we're talking about?
Well, we're talking about journalists for, let's say, I don't know, BuzzFeed News or Vice or
New York Times. Yeah, I'm not sure if they're on the payroll. I'm sure some of the high-level ones are. What I noticed from my time is just dealing with personal ignorance, personal biases, an unwillingness to avail ourselves to the depths of the darkness that are really running the world right now. So what I just noticed was, like, I don't think the intelligence agencies need to pay these people to be their gatekeepers. It comes to groupthink. It just comes to, I don't have the capacity to take in the extent of darkness, and I don't want to be ostracized, so I'm not going to look into these things. I mean, I went through this at the LA Weekly for decades. When Obama was first running for president, I flooded all the political writers with links and videos, and back then they just thought I was the crazy conspiracy theorist, and they wouldn't look at anything. And it was frustrating for me, where I was like, look, it's fine if you want to judge me, but as a journalist who's, you know, helping to educate Los Angeles as to what is going on politically, you have an obligation to look at all of the information. What I realize is very few journalists actually have integrity or a solid work ethic. So I think it might come down more to incompetence and weakness of character than being on the payroll.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Danny. I was going to say, because Bernstein, Carl Bernstein, you know, the Watergate guy, he left the Washington Post and wrote a long article for Rolling Stone magazine talking about Mockingbird, Operation Mockingbird. He said dozens, hundreds of journalists were actually on the CIA payroll. And I wondered if that was still true, because that was written over 40 years ago. But Danny Katz, you've talked to us and told us about your project –